Dr. Anthony Harkins is Director of Popular Culture Studies, Major and Associate Professor in the Department of History at Western Kentucky University. His topic is, as you can see on the screen, From a Savage Threat to Civilization to Comical Anachronism, the Evolution of the Media Image of Appalachian Foods. Dr. Harkins received his master's degree and PhD in history from the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He has contributed to several publications, including the Register of the Kentucky Historical Society, the Encyclopedia of Appalachia, and is author of Hillbilly, A Cultural History of an American Icon. And in addition, he won the J. William Fulbright Fellowship in the spring of 2012. And Dr. Harkins, thanks so much for being here yesterday and today, and we look forward to your presentation.
Okay, well, thank you. And can everyone hear okay? Okay. Thank you all for sticking around. It's been a very enjoyable day and a lot of different approaches to this. And one thing I'm reaching the conclusion is about this whole conference on feuding is that there really is no such thing as feuding. And we've sort of looked at it from all different angles. And I'm going to look at it from the media perspective, the kind of even one further step removed in some ways. I am a popular culture historian, at least that's how I think of myself. And so I'm talking about images and the perceptions and the meanings that people hold, and very rarely about actual people other than the people making the media. So we'll go from there. So obviously all of this has been started in many ways, I think, by this Hatfields and McCoys miniseries. And there's one short scene in there where Randall McCoy is posed for a photograph by a newspaper man, and then he's encouraged to hold a gun, and then that picture goes out. And I think it's an all-too-brief hint at the enormous role that the media has played in constructing and perpetuating the idea that Southern Mountaineers are violent feudists ready to fight at a moment's notice, right? So I'm going to try to trace the evolution and the history of this image and this identity. And one thing that'll be very clear, and maybe everyone already knows this, is that the way feuding comes to be seen through the media is kind of the polar opposite of what it actually was, which was wealthy people or relatively wealthy people competing about power. And it's almost always presented as people utterly outside of any sort of economic, social, or political reality. Yeah. And I think it's also interesting how the waxing and waning of interest in hillbillies and feuding connects to wider awareness of economic hardship and sort of uncertainty of where America is going and where society is and what gender roles should be and all those sorts of things. So in many ways, I think it's always a sort of space through which these issues get debated and considered. So therefore, it cannot be divorced from the media-constructed hillbilly. And I've tried to sort of differentiate here. But feuding and hillbilly very much go sort of hand in hand because it encapsulates all the qualities associated with this cultural icon: violence, backwardness, irrationality, amorality, unwillingness to change, and spatial and chronological isolation. And I think there's many ways in which hillbillies get framed as not just living like it's in the past, but literally in the past, like they are literally outside of time and space. And we'll see that a number of times here, I think. Audiences' longstanding fascination with feuding, and it is something I'm still wrestling with, and maybe you can all help answer this at the end. Why do people still care so much about these images and this word Hatfield McCoy, so that it just keeps coming up and up and up again and again? And, you know, that six-hour miniseries, I mean, I didn't think it was exactly compelling television, but somehow, just this enormous interest in it, and all these books come out, and people want to go, and as Bob was pointing out, you know, people want to go and sort of look at this disastrous situation in many ways and make it into a tourist attraction, and you know, just very few other examples of that. Anyway, this longstanding fascination reveals, I think, how they've served this space through which Americans have considered what they've lost and gained in their headlong rush to industrial urban modernity. Now, one of the things I argue in the book, and I'll argue here, is that I think much of this has to do with the fact that they are representatives of what I call a white other, that they are Anglo-Saxon Protestant Americans, but living outside of the generally accepted parameters of whiteness, that is, middle classness, economic security, connection to modern conveniences and technology. And in this way, they are fundamentally ambiguous characters. My argument about the hillbilly is that what sustains it is its ambiguity, that it has positive and negative traits simultaneously competing with one another all the time. So they signify both rugged individualism, sort of stalwart American pioneer spirit, but also stubborn backwardness. They signify cultural and social isolation, but also an unshakable sense of place and self. Right, in a country which is constantly moving and constantly changing. They signify strong family and kin networks on the sort of positive end, but then, of course, feuding and inbreeding on the negative end. Right, and so these things are always intertwined. And so middle-class white Americans could see these people as intriguing and an exotic race, really a kind of separate race within whiteness, culturally and morally akin to blacks and Indians, yet also sympathize with them as poor or less modern versions of themselves. And because of their whiteness, it also permits them to be crudely characterized long after similar stereotypes of blacks and Indians and even ethnic groups, you know, Irish and Italians and everything, becomes unacceptable anymore. It's still okay to present these images and to use terms like white trash, you know, which is just an incredibly vulgar term, but one that is just routinely used in popular culture today. Okay, so the idea of Appalachia as a distinct region, and I'll go through this part relatively quickly because we've covered it a number of times in the other talks, emerges, I think, in the 1860s and 1870s with the local color writers, magazines like The Century and Scribner's and Harper's. And they published, between 1870 and 1890, over 90 travel sketches and 125 short stories about the Appalachian region. So there's a sort of explosion of interest in it. And in an era of nearly unquestioned faith in the cultural and intellectual superiority of Western people and civilizations, I think these stories were meant to show not so much cultural difference, but cultural hierarchy, and to romanticize the past while pointing out all the time the benefits of modern industrial society. So here's a couple images from some local color articles by E.W. Kemble, who was a big illustrator of the time. And these writings presented Appalachia as a picturesque landscape populated by colorful, even quirky, men and women, oddly out of step with modern society. Simply put, in the words of one title, it was a strange land and a peculiar people. More of a curiosity than a concern, this fictionalized Appalachia served primarily to point out the benefits of advanced civilization and to offer northern urbanites a kind of virtual visit to a mysterious but ultimately safe wilderness from which they could return refreshed to their place in the modern cosmopolitan social order. Yeah. And these local color writers were not just writing about Appalachia, they're writing about Maine, they're writing about Louisiana, various places, you know, on the outskirts of modern life, supposedly. Beginning in the 1880s, as we've seen, this image starts to change dramatically, and there's a growing notion that the people of the mountains of Kentucky and eventually the southern mountains more generally, it's interesting how feuding, it's from my understanding of it, is pretty much, the idea of feuding is pretty much centered in Kentucky, but it gets applied to the entire Appalachian region, even though there's no evidence of that, even beyond the little evidence that there is in Kentucky. That these people are not just out of step with, but actually threatened civilization itself. And the twin evils of moonshining and feuding become the focus of dozens of accounts in both regional and national newspapers. Altina Waller has been a huge influence on all of us. Notes in her article, 41 separate family-oriented conflicts reported between 1874 and 1893 alone. Now, at first, these are seen as the results of ongoing political power struggles in Kentucky and the state's unique violent past. But as the series of murders get reported on, it shifts to the idea both within the Democratic Louisville Courier Journal and the Republican New York Times. It's interesting how political party doesn't make a difference in this case. Both of them condemned the people of the mountains as degenerate barbarians whose conflicts stemmed not from political or economic disputes, but from cultural or even genetic traits inherited from their wild Scottish Highland ancestors. We've all seen how that's not true. It's interesting how the wording even changes. The initial wording is vendetta, and which has the sort of Corsican roots. And then the shift to the word feud emphasizes this Scottish Highland ancestry, right? And newspapers around the country argued that the mountain people threatened, this is exactly what John just said, threatened not just regional but national economic prosperity and social stability. You know? And anyone who opposed this was backwards and deviant, and very much raced in this way too, that they were akin to colonial peoples anywhere in the world who were challenging Western control. So here's a great quote from a Baltimore Sun editorial of 1912 about a shootout that happened in Hillsville, Virginia. And the paper thundered, "There are but two remedies for such a situation as this. They are education and extermination." With many of the individuals, the latter is the only remedy. Men and races alike, when they defy civilization, must die. The mountaineers of Virginia and Kentucky and North Carolina, like the Red Indians and the South African Boers, must learn this lesson. Yeah. So, I mean, there's no pussyfooting around here at all, right? And this is somewhat more severe than most editorials, but nonetheless, I think it's representative of the conflation of the actions of a single family with an entire regional population, and its comparison of southern mountaineers to other primitive peoples beyond the pale of civilization. And obviously, nothing solidifies this more than the stories about the Hatfield-McCoy feud, which we've talked about a lot. T.C. Crawford's An American Vendetta, a story of barbarism, presents this portrait, which describes these savage and isolated people living in murder land. And the iconography very much is part of this as well, right? So this is from the frontispiece of this book of Devil Anse, presenting him as this sort of tough-as-nails, rifle-toting mountain patriarch, flowing dark beard, wide-brimmed hat. You can very much see the hillbilly in formation here. Now, I don't know how much he was part of the decision to present this in the book, because I don't know that history so well. But he definitely remains a sort of media celebrity and kind of uses that to some degree. And, of course, this very famous image that you've all seen by an itinerant photographer long after the feud is over, taken of his family in West Virginia, is widely reprinted everywhere and is still widely reprinted everywhere. Of grim, grim-visaged desperados. And this comes to represent the image of all mountain folk to modern America. Yeah. And then these ideas of the feudists get picked up by novelists, most famously by John Fox Jr. here. The one on the right is from the movie that's made from the Trail of the Lonesome Pine. In fact, multiple times it was made. And Little Shepherd of Kingdom Come. Novels from 1895 through 1907. And Fox presents this vision of the chasm that separated civilized society and the degraded culture of violent and backwards mountain moonshiners and feudists. And these stories, in turn, become the proof of the conditions in the mountains themselves that are picked up by journalists and scholars and benevolence workers in the turn of the century. So, for instance, the University of Chicago sociologist George Vincent wrote a book, article, 1898, A Retarded Frontier, different meaning of retarded, although not, maybe not entirely. And he reiterates the standard claim that the mountain folk are nearly completely isolated from the outside world. The fact of this is based on his four-day trip through eastern Kentucky, and, quote, the vivid stories of Miss Murfree, Mr. John Fox Jr., and other writers. So the novels become the proof of the reality of the mountains. Yeah. And even in his articles, he's struggling with the fact that this doesn't quite gel with what he's actually experienced. So he and other authors note how they found it hard to reconcile the standard reports of universal mountaineer ignorance and viciousness with their own experience in the region. But in the end, the ideological power of the myth of the White Mountain Savages is simply too strong to offset their doubts about its veracity, and they just sort of take it as truth. In the oft-quoted words of Berea College President William Frost, they were our contemporary ancestors. Yeah. And Fox Jr. also wrote nonfiction works about them as well, including something called The Southern Mountaineer. And here he talks about how, because they are imprisoned in their mountain fastness, they become a type of human fossil. Dress, speech, religion, customs, ideas have been caught like the shapes of the lower life in stone, and tell the human story of a century as the rocks tell the story of an age. This is a very common idea, that the mountains have trapped them in the past, and that they are living. There's always things about how if William Shakespeare came to America, he would instantly recognize and understand everybody, that they are trapped in this past and really kind of not part of this the passage of time, that they're kind of this permanent place in the past. But on the other hand, he and others argued that this geographic and temporal isolation also, although very threatening in some ways, also preserved qualities and a racial purity that had built the America they cherished and feared was fast disappearing in the rapidly racially and ethnically diversifying nation. So part of the fascination with the idea of the mountaineer and the feud image is that they were white Anglo-Saxon Protestants who had very large families. And at a time where there were lots of fears of the idea of race suicide, that whites were wiping themselves out and they were going to be overwhelmed by Eastern Europeans and such, if these people could be properly modernized and civilized and made good Protestants, right, this is the right kind of Protestants, then they offered a form of national salvation. So this ongoing fascination with these images, I think, is tied to very much tied to that idea. Now, the place that this really spreads widely, of course, is motion pictures, is silent films. And this mix of ideas of social threat and cultural purity is at the heart of this huge number of silent films. Astounding, between 1904 and 1920, there are 400 movies produced that feature colorful mountaineers and mountain settings. Now, most of these are one-reelers or two-reelers. They're still very short films. But still, that number is just astounding. And then 76 more through the 1920s. And they're produced by leading movie companies of the day, important directors like D.W. Griffith, who makes six of them for Biograph, set in Kentucky. Of course, filmed in the wilds of New Jersey, because that's where motion pictures were made at that time. Fort Lee, New Jersey, right? It's the center of motion picture industry. Of course, Hatfields and McCoys, I don't know if everyone knows this, it was filmed in Romania, right? So I'll talk about that later. So all one or two reelers until World War I, shown in Nickelodeons to largely working class and ethnic audiences. These films featured highly melodramatic storylines, nonstop action, horse chases, characters falling or leaping from cliffs, and, of course, fighting in all forms, right? Feuding families, battles between moonshiners and revenueers, love triangles that pitted a male urbanite against a mountaineer man for a mountaineer woman's affections. All of this ensured that nearly every film featured one or more killings. Yeah. The Last of Their Race from 1914, the killing is so wanton that by the film's end, only two adversaries of once large rival clans remain standing. And keep that idea in mind for later. The amount of violence here is amazing. There are nearly 500 mountain films. There are over 200 murders, 500 assaults with guns, axes, or hand-to-hand combat, 100 attacks on women. And women, too, are involved in the shooting and the capturing and the horse riding and everything as well. So as unambiguous melodramas, the films nearly always concluded with the restoration of the proper social order, with the feudists either dead or in the hands of the law, and socially dominant urban men once again firmly in charge of both mountain men and also temporarily violent and rule-breaking women. Still, largely working-class Nickelodeon audiences, I think, may have come away with a very different opposite set of messages. Just because they end that way doesn't mean that's the meaning of the whole movie that people watched it. They very well may have come away with the idea that of the thrilling possibility of transgressing gender and class boundaries and norms, the excitement and allure of life in the wilderness, in contrast to the crowded and regimented nature of industrial America, the secret satisfaction of challenging and even besting, no matter how briefly, the forces of social order and control. So I think it's this ambiguity, the possible meaning of the mountaineer, the way you can use it in different ways, that made them so popular and that sustained these images throughout the century and across the cultural spectrum. So initially, in the early 1900s, 1910s, even in the 1920s, this idea of the savage feudist, the savage mountaineer, wanton killing is absolutely dominant. And this persists into the 1930s, but particularly into the 20s, some typical titles of films, Seeds of Vengeance, The Valley of Hate, Souls Aflame, the last one described in Variety as a convincing picturization of a half-civilized, semi-barbarous folk. But at the end, by the end of World War I, this genre had been so thoroughly exploited and overwhelmingly exhausted that both critics and exhibitors started to condemn them as too predictable and too much of type. A review of a Tom Mix film, The Feud, in the moving picture world in 1919, said, "This title will not sell readily. It is trite and suggestive of a theme badly overworked." So people were just getting exhausted by the endless stream of these films. So by 1911, even, you start to have semi-parodies of the feud image. Ferdy's Family Feud from 1912, or The Contents of a Suitcase, 1913, parodied the melodramatic storylines and acting of the mountaineer genre and featured naive city folk or travelers comically stumbling into the midst of family feuds and moonshine rings, something that you would see over and over again in later productions as well. Featuring feuding families like the Higginsons and the Judsons, or revenue agent Snitz, various goofy names, and starring leading silent comedy stars like Fatty Arbuckle, Buster Keaton, Harold Lloyd, and others. These comedies reveal that the exclusive conception of mountaineers and their culture as a legitimate threat to modern civilization was beginning to dissipate, and in its place was emerging a parallel but distinct interpretation of the mountaineer as a humorous hillbilly persona. What's really interesting, though, is that the iconography, the images themselves, don't change at all. It's the very same costuming, the very same storylines in many ways, but now the meaning is comical and not threatening. Once the mountaineers as white others formed a colorful scenic backdrop for the proving of middle-class white male virility and ultimately superiority, and now they serve as comic foils for bumbling urban naives in standard fish-out-of-water plots. This shift also suggests changes in the film industry more generally. First of all, the main one is the shift to Hollywood in 1914. Secondly, films become longer. They become photo plays rather than one or two reelers, and they start to be designed for middle-class clientele and refined picture palaces rather than working-class Nickelodeons. As the locale of wilderness scene shifted from the southern mountains to the western range and the California foothills, cowboy movies became increasingly prominent film genre. The cattle rustler and the sheriff and his posse replaced the moonshiner and the revenue agent, and the outlaws replaced feudists. By 1919, even a movie with as reliably a mountaineer title as A Moonshine Feud would feature a heroine named Texas and a shootout on horseback across a western prairie. So we just shift directions. And it strikes me that the Hatfield McCoys, the Kevin Costner one, is a kind of return to the Western. And one thing I'm thinking about is that maybe the Western has been unacceptable, you know, has been shifted unacceptable. You can't show them killing Indians anymore, and you can't show, you know, that's not allowed. So this becomes a safe way for people to kill each other because they're all white, so therefore it's okay, you know. I do think there's something to that. Okay, so even though urban moviegoers had evidently lost interest and faith in the believability of feud and moonshine plot lines, Hollywood's belief that for a movie going public, Southern mountain folk continued to be synonymous with primitive savagery remained unassailable. So here's what we saw yesterday, many of you, Tallable David. And here's just one example of this. So the star, Richard Barthelmess, and director Henry King stressed to reporters when the movie was being made that, quote, this was not a story of a feud or moonshiners, and they wanted to capture the real atmosphere of the Virginia mountains. And the film is filmed on location in Highland, Virginia. And we saw that yesterday. But at the same time, King exploited the feud myth. He evidently felt that audiences saw it as essential. And so he talked to reporters about the causes and sensational results of family feuds. And he claimed that his crew, his film crew, had been stopped on their way to their filming site by a gang of armed men in pursuit of a rival clan. This simultaneous rejection and embrace of the feuding myth was perfectly captured in a Louisville Herald review that noted that the film, though melodramatic, reveals, quote, the eye-for-an-eye creed of the mountain feudist, and, quote, and this is a great quote, end quote, appears to be life as the story writers have taught us to believe life is in the mountains of Kentucky and Virginia. So they try to have it both ways there. Still, the shift of cultural meaning from deadly serious to absurdly comical was unmistakable. And here's another film from 1923, Buster Keaton, Our Hospitality. The plot line is the character learns he's inherited his father's estate. He's been taken away as an orphan and up to the city. He learns that he's inherited his father's estate. He's sure that it's a palatial plantation that awaits him. Despite his aunt's warnings, he heads back to the Blue Ridge Mountains to claim his prize, and of course it's only a rundown cabin shack. It's the exact same plot line that Barney Google introduces Snuffy Smith in 1934, the exact same plot line. Keaton spends the rest of his film avoiding becoming the victim of the hospitality of the rival family of the Canfields. Now, as you see here, they are portrayed not as impoverished and wild hill folk, but as aristocrats of the planter class who lived in a stately mansion. And this suggests that the idea of warring hillbillies grows out of earlier conceptions of dueling, perhaps, from southern elites. And the film is also set in the early 19th century, makes a big point of this, has an opening prologue card which says, once upon a time, in certain sections of the United States, there were feuds that ran from generation to generation. So it kind of distances itself from contemporary feuding. It's a typical kind of Buster Keaton comedy. Strikingly, though, some reviewers had trouble finding the humor in an image of family battles to the death. One reviewer wrote, "We have our doubts whether a takeoff of the Southern feud story could ever be made consistently humorous because of its melodramatic character." But this trend continues. Here is 1934, Kentucky Colonels. Burt Wheeler and Robert Woolsey. Hackneyed plot devices, they come into the feud country after they learn that the child they are guarding has recently inherited a Kentucky estate. Maybe that sounds familiar. As in Keaton's film, the leaders of the feuding Wakefields are a southern plantation family. But other men in the clan are dressed in a variety of rustic costumes, from plaid shirts and slouch hats to cowboy hats and string ties. Sort of throw it all at the screen and see what works. In the ensuing battle, the rivals are more explicitly presented as stereotypical mountaineers. They are congregated around a moonshine still outside a log cabin. But they, too, are costumed more like lumberjacks than like stereotypical hillbillies to come. The word hillbilly is not used anywhere in the film or the script. So although comically violent, the mountaineer characters are not yet slothful and unhygienic. By 1938, Kentucky Moonshine with the Ritz Brothers, which are kind of a, maybe some of you remember the Ritz Brothers, the less zany, less successful Marx Brothers. This has come into full bloom. So here they are presented as iconic, lazy, overbearded, overhatted. hillbillies. From the plotline of New York singers becoming immersed in a feud between two mountain clans, the Hatfields and the Slacks, reference to child brides, laziness, the town they appear in there is Coma, Kentucky, the shock of wearing shoes, yeah, and lyrics such as, "Oh, we're the Slacks from Coma, and you'll pardon our aroma." The film consistently presents mountaineers as absurdly degenerate. Still, it's deemed as totally uncontroversial. Private citizen review boards described it as hilarious and wholesome. Time magazine called it the presentation of hillbilly doings, typically untypical. So it's still like in its phases, right? Its early phases. And this image comes explicitly from a particular locale, which is the Mountain Boys from Esquire magazine. I'll show you. And these emerge in 1934. You have two comic strips and this comic that all appear in the same year. So you have Snuffy Smith, comes out of Barney Google in 1934. Little Abner, Al Capps Little Abner starts the same year. And in Esquire magazine, the Mountain Boys. And this was the very first appearance of them. And this is the caption. And you can see how this is this total reversal of everything proper, so that the men are outside, the animals are inside. You have guns, you have moonshine, you have this broken wagon wheel, right, sort of a rusted car in the front yard kind of its day. I love the one boot, but none of them are wearing them, right? So they have the capacity to improve, but they refuse to do so. And then this sexualized image as well, of course, so that grown men who are wondering if the baby is born yet. And of course, the baby becomes Uncle Rafe, this little baby who's their uncle. And you know, I'm getting mighty hungry. And of course, women as perpetually pregnant and sexed. And it's really amazing that this appears in Esquire, which is the total opposite of all of this, but that's sort of the idea, right? Now, actually, in the Mountain Boys, there's not a whole lot of feuding plot lines. There are plot lines, feuding plot lines in Barney Google. So here's one image from 1936 of, you see the range of people descending back over the second hill there. And so unconcerned about it all, the one guy's wondering if it's going to rain or not. I'm sorry, I'm doing that. And also in Little Abner, the ongoing feud between the Yoakums and the Scrags, and this is the Scrags at the bottom here, who are just utterly vicious savages. There's cannibalism in the warriors. It becomes just incredibly ugly. But this idea that they're sort of, you know, destroying everything that they touch, and here they are coming east like a tornado and then showing up at the wealthy socialite's house here. But in terms of fully exploiting the stereotype of lazy, slovenly, rustic oafs, nothing could compare with animated shorts and that were a semi-regular feature of major animation studios in the 1930s. I want to show you a clip from one. This is called A Feud There Was, Tex Avery, 1938. It's the first one there. Yeah, and you can expand the screen, I think. We'll just see a few minutes of this. Thank you. Okay. Okay. Now, if you'll just pull it forward a little bit, Scott, no, to the kid in the chimney, that's fine. And just wait a second. So anyway, you can see there the idea of laziness, right, that this is a culture defined by nothing happening, utterly outside of anything happening, except when they're feuding, and then they suddenly spring into action. And so there's this really weird kind of blend of doing absolutely nothing and then doing savage violence as well. Go ahead. The first appearance of Elmer Fudd. It's called Egghead. Okay. That's good.
What year was that?
This is 1938. Okay. If you go to YouTube, Feud There Was, you can watch the whole thing. So, you know, you have this explosion of cartoons in newspapers and in film and in animated shorts. And what accounts for this explosion of hillbilly imagery at this time? In the 1930s. Well, obviously, it's a complex mix of emotions. It is certainly part of widespread public fear of systemic economic and social collapse, right, that we're all going to become hillbillies in a sense. It's also, I think, these highly exaggerated portraits of impoverished but basically content Southern hill folk also could provide cheering reassurance that rural poverty was not as bleak as it appeared in news accounts. And more cynically, that the pleasures of laughing at the misfortune of others, or confirmation that the poor deserve their poverty because of innate laziness and ignorance, that poverty was a choice rather than a result of exploitation and lack of opportunities. On the other hand, can you go to the PowerPoint? Sorry, I had this all brilliantly worked out in one thing, and then it didn't work. That green one, yeah, good. In the bottom, yeah, there you go. Okay, so on the other hand, it could also reflect, I think, a more positive vision of the durability of the American people and the American spirit in the face of adversity and the persistence of folk values. So here's another Mountain Boys cartoon. Where he says, you know, you better wake Paul up before it starts raining again. He's over there under that tree, right? So these people who can survive anything, who nothing bothers them, they can be drowning in water and they're just fine. And that idea that, you know, this sort of gives you a sense that America can survive the Depression as well, although maybe you have to become hillbillies in order to do so. So it's a kind of double-edged sword, I think, that's always there. This general celebration of, or at least acceptance of, these feuding hillbilly stereotypes persists through World War II, But opposition to it does start to grow, and it becomes increasingly viewed as an offensive, racially based stereotype, as particularly as hundreds of thousands of people come out of the mountains and pour into Midwestern and Mid-Atlantic cities to work in war production jobs or fight in the war. And the best example of this change in thinking is the reaction to the next video I'm going to show you, which is from the 1946 Disney film called Make Mine Music. And this is one sketch from that film called The Martins and the Coys, based on a song written in 1936 by professional songwriters called The Martins and the Coys. Really interesting history of this song. It was professionally sung by Gene Autry and Woody Guthrie. And then in 1944, Alan Lomax from the Folk Collector and becomes tied to the Library of Congress, makes a ballad opera called based on The Martins and the Coys for the BBC, because they're in England at the time. And this ballad opera features Will Greer, Woody Guthrie, Burl Ives, Lily Mae Ledford, and Pete Seeger. And the plot line of the ballad opera is that the Martins and the Coys, sort of the Hatfields and McCoys, obviously, put aside their differences, join up, and go over to Germany to kill Hitler. And it includes the All You Fascists Must Die song. And so it's a really interesting progressive kind of spin on the whole thing. Anyway, this is the Disney version, the Martins and the Coys.
Thank you.
Okay, and just drag it to the near the end. Might have to pause it first. I don't know. I just want to show you the very end of it. Just pull the dot there. Yeah. There you go. There's a square dance scene. Skip that part. Okay, that's good. Yeah. So try to imagine that with African American characters or Asian American characters. It's unthinkable, and yet this appears as part of a children's show, right? Essentially, what's interesting though is the reaction to it is very different than in earlier portrayals. James Agee in The Nation finds it infinitely insulting. The Common Wheel calls it tasteless. And in the new context of the Double V campaign, the NAACP's campaign against fascism and racism, the Holocaust that is starting to emerge in people's consciousness, the whole idea of racism as a sort of acceptable thing becoming utterly unacceptable, this too becomes part of that category. Time Reviewer wrote that it would offend those who think such caricatures are as insulting as the hush my mouth kind of comic contempt for Negroes. So there's a growing sort of awareness that this is a racialized other. What's really interesting is the future history of this show. So it's still being used. The Muppet Show did a version of it in 1980, and with all the kind of shooting and everything. But when Disney re-releases this Make Mine Music, which, by the way, was a big flop, and it was supposed to be kind of the working man's fantasia, and it was a kind of disaster. When they re-released it in 1980, they cut this out of it. They cut the Martins and the Coys out of it because of all the gun violence, but I think also because of just the offensive nature of the stereotype. And there is another clip in there of a whale who wants to sing at the opera, where there are the very clear kind of Negro stereotypes, typical kind of watermelon and things like that, and that stayed in. Now, this feuding storyline persists in comic films and animated shorts into the 1960s, but not in dramatic versions. The last dramatic film about the feud story is Rosanna McCoy, and that's from 1949. there is one last rendition of the feud theme and the hillbilly, the fascination with the hillbilly in the 1960s, airing at the time of the rediscovery of poverty and the writings of Michael Harrington and Harry Cottle and Lyndon Johnson's War on Poverty, of course. And I think things like the Beverly Hillbillies and the Andy Griffith Show and other things like that are very much part and parcel of that. I'll just show you one quick minute from first season of the Beverly Hillbillies. And this one's called The Great Feud, and I'll just play you the song part. This is before they had the song, so. Let's go on the Butler fella, Mr. Butler. Okay, so you can see that there are a number of old standard ideas here, but also that they have been transformed. I think one of the things that makes Beverly Hillbillies so successful is that it domesticates the version of our familiar persona and removes a lot of its surface debasement and slovenliness. You don't have long beards, you don't have outhouses, you don't have bare feet in the show. You have, of course, cornpone puns and ridiculous sight gags and this absurd storyline of impoverished mountain folks becoming instant millionaires and moving to California. But it also, I think, in many ways, is a sustained critique of the wealthy, the venality and the shallowness of modern American life, and a parody, much more than a parody of rural life, although it's both those things. It's worth noting here that the feud is not based on, although it is based on a supposed mountaineer's code and these outmoded notions of paternalism and patriarchy, it is not rooted in long-forgotten slights between two hill families, but rather the careless egotism and class privilege of the shifty city dude. Yeah. And some critics at the time recognized what a fundamental challenge this show presented to, quote, money-oriented value system. And in fact, this guy wrote that there's no way it could stay on television because it's just too challenging to the social order. But obviously, the absurd storylines and the impossible naivete of the characters undermines any legitimate social criticism it contains. And it became increasingly apolitical as time went on and becomes more about, you know, giant kangaroos and things like that. So that brings us to the present and the sudden rebirth of fascination with feuds with the Hatfields and McCoys show and this conference. This hit has led to a lot of derivative film versions as well, a big spike in feud-related books, tourism boom. We've talked about all that. Certainly the show has, for the moment anyway, purged the comical connotations from the image of the Mountaineer feud. There's hardly a single moment of levity in that six-hour show. No one even cracks a smile, as I recall. And it has returned to the earlier vision of Mountaineer feudists as a deadly threat to modern society, only hinting in very small ways at the way it is a product of that industrializing modernization. Filmed in Romania, the series has nonetheless been fairly widely praised as the most accurate filmed portrayal of the historical events. And, you know, that may be true. It's not a terribly high bar to reach. Still, the ultimate message most critics and viewers took away, I think, is summed up by a New York Times film reviewer. He acknowledged the broader backstory and historical contextualization, but he continued, quote, "It distracts from the real business at hand, which is Hatfields and McCoys shooting at one another." Right? That's what it's all about. So in closing, I'll note that the show's success, I think, taps into broader current fascination with mountain and southern rural culture more generally in this huge spate of reality TV shows. And I'll just list some of them here. The Call of the Wild Man, which is a Kentucky guy, of course. Hillbilly Hand Fishing, Hillbilly Blood, Duck Dynasty, Mountain Men, Swamp People, Buck Wild, and there's probably more, right? This is this explosion of these images. What all that means, I'll save for another time. But I think it does show, regardless of what you think of the artistic and historical merit of all of this, it does show that, as it has for over a century, this idea of the hillbilly and the blood feud still fascinates audiences. It continues to serve as a mythic space through which modern Americans try to define themselves and their national identity, and try to reconcile their past and their present. Thank you. Question? Please.
On the other hand, hasn't there been even today a glorification and romanticizing of godliness?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. No, absolutely. And that was part of the Beverly Hillbillies, too, right? Yeah.
I remember my mother, though she left a small town upstate New York, she finished school, she always referred to that area as God's country. And Sarah Palin, in the 2008 campaign, went into a rural area of Missouri or something like that, and gave a speech to a small crowd of white people. Mm-hmm. It's so nice to be in the real America.
Right.
And
right.
Then we go back to Thomas Jefferson's glorification of the virtuous yeoman farmer, mm-hmm. and cities are mm-hmm. evil mm-hmm. and corrupting.
Sure. So it's a very long tradition in American history. And that's the ambiguous part of this, right? That on one hand, it can be seen as people who are racially and morally and spiritually pure, and you know, and maintaining the old ways that made America great and things like that, and rugged individualism, and also connection to the land, connection to place, knowing who you are. The Beverly Hillbillies is all about people who know who they are and a lot of people who don't know who they are, and they're just chasing after money all the time because they don't know who they are, right? So you always have that positive element to it, but it can flip on a dime and become deliverance, right? I mean, it just happens instantly, I think. Yeah. Yes, please. What's that? Absolutely. No, absolutely true. And I do cover that more in my book. But this is very selective oftentimes, too, right? That there are those linguistic traits, and there are those folk traditions and those folk music traditions, but they weren't exclusively speaking that way and exclusively singing Barbary Allen all the time, you know? And people like Cecil Sharp goes and collects music, but he collects what he wants to collect, and he doesn't collect what he doesn't want to collect. And they're listening to vaudeville, and they're listening to Tin Pan Alley stuff, too. Right. Right. Right.
At that time, they had no legitimate culture to document. He didn't,
right.
So he focused on the few cases of the old balladeers.
Right. Right.
That became the story.
Right. And folk culture is very much framed as the sort of salvation of the world from modern industrial popular culture, working class culture. And this is going to be, you know, reclaim culture from the working class people themselves and sort of reestablish what used to be legitimate back in the old days when you didn't have an industrial working class. So, and the photography is the same thing. Like in the 30s and stuff, these pictures of Appalachian people did have, you know, quilts and spinning wheels and things like that. But they also had more modern stuff, and that stuff does not get into the photographs. And many times there's very explicit kind of posing of people in this way. So you're absolutely right. That's very central to the whole thing. And you see how country music or mountain music or whatever, some version of it, is always part of the hillbilly representation as well. But I think it's very selective in that way, too.
What is the number of this population?
Excuse me?
What is the number of this population?
The number of the population? You want to speak to that, John?
Of the Appalachian region?
Yeah.
There's 400 and some counties, right? So it's significant.
Yeah.
The German Appalachians, I don't know. They're all the way from New York to Texas.
They pay taxes. Sure. Sure. Part of what I'm trying to point out is the distortion of these images, that they are outside of space and time when they are very much not outside of space and time, right? They're working in coal mines. They're working, you know, in the earlier period, they're lumbering, and now they're in Walmart, you know? I mean, they're part of the economic system. But they get framed this way because it's a way to sort of deny the culpability of the system for the poverty and everything that many people face, I think.
Well, I had a guy that fell back with the boy and told me that I wasn't really from West Virginia because I was from the city. Yeah. In West Virginia. I was from Huntington.
Right.
And that didn't fit his image of what West Virginia was.
Right. 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 Question.
Do you feel this fascination with imputing, not that they say, nuclear
Ohio and say, Bapiosa.
Right. No, absolutely. No, absolutely. People like, right, outlaws, and people like that, absolutely. They do, and they also adopt this sort of stuff too, you know, and this becomes an international image of the South, you know, more generally. But certainly, I mean, there's always this fascination with people shooting each other. But the ways that it gets erased from any sort of actual reality, you know, is one of the things I'm trying to talk about. But I don't think it's uniquely American, although I do think the speed in which things change in America makes people have a need for it to some degree, to a greater extent. There are things like Ned Kelly and an Australian outlaw and things like that. There are other cultures where they have these sort of outlaw stories, but it's not so much, I don't think it's so much whole cultures, you know, whole groups of people trapped in isolated areas. You know.
Mm-hmm. Love that story. Mm-hmm. If you watched one and couldn't even get past the lack of accent, and didn't watch it again, it was a big thing to them. And of course, they're getting that and taking it verbatim. But Romeo, it's the romance mm-hmm. that appealed to mm-hmm. them. It wasn't, I don't think, shooting per se. That hasn't been talked about at all. Was there a romance from both families? I don't know.
In the Hatfields and McCoys?
Yeah.
There was a relationship. I don't think it was as central as it's usually made out to be.
It's normally the
right, but as Dr. Waller pointed out, the family—it's not really two families; it's two groups of economic actors, and so you know they're not really sort of separate in that way. I mean, we love this idea of a family against a family. I think that's part of the appeal—is you know the kind of mafia kind of you know idea and Shakespeare, right? But that notion, you know, just so locked into that you cannot allow any sort of reality to creep in because that would destroy that kind of dream of the, you know, the dream of the families fighting each other, you know.
Actually, Devil Lance's son is usually paired up in the romantic dimension.
Jonesy, yeah.
Boy. Well, they had a child together, I think. But she wouldn't marry Johnson Hatfield. And the story was, well, that Devil Lance got upset about it. Johnson later married her cousin.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right. Right. So it's not so much that. I do also think that part of the appeal is just. Yeah, I think part of the appeal is also it's just a useful idea of this sort of two groups at war with each other over nothing. It's just a very useful idea that applies to, you know, neighbors and it applies to all sorts of things in life. And so it just sort of serves that function. But it has to be about nothing. That's the really central part of this, right? Is it's always something like the Andy Griffith one, if you saw that. It's always about something that's long ago been forgotten, what it was actually about, which, again, removes it from an economic and social and political reality.
Well, to add on to that, in the late Victorian era, when all of this was in the media, the family was looked upon as a sort of protection
right.
from everything going on in the big bad world, whether it meant capitalism, or politics, or what have you. And so the home and the hearth were meant to be something basically sacred. So when you said that this was a conflict between two families, it made it somehow special.
Mm-hmm.
And not as blasé as just something, a remainder from the local economic problems or what have you.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think there's a special element to that mythology that is very attractive to Americans because they're always scared of losing. Americans are always scared of losing the basic family unit.
Right.
And to some extent, I suppose the United States has lost it
right.
compared to our past.
Right. Well, I also thought that might help explain why the Hatfields and McCoys becomes the feud
yeah.
that everyone has heard about. Because when the children are killed and the wife is beaten, you know, that sort of raises it up a notch beyond just guys killing guys, right? Because that's what guys do. But that when they start killing women and children, right, in this world where patriarchy is so central and where you're losing control of all aspects of your life, and that's the one thing you can hold on to as a man is, you know, the control of your family in yeah. some sense. I think that might be part of
it,
too.
It's also the Hatfield and McCoys is also the one that is the least obviously connected to politics.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. So you can say it's about nothing because it's the
easier to do so. Yeah. Any other questions? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.